welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with Dr. Mark Felden about a U.S. and German combined operation during World War II to save some very important riding horses. A fascinating story which many people don't know about. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Felden, author of Ghost Riders, When U.S. and German Soldiers Fought Together to Save the World's Most Beautiful Horses in the Last Days of World War II. And here's the book just for anyone to see. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
Well, this was this sort of came to me as a bit of a gift, really. I was hunting around doing research on other books, and I just happened to come across some references to the idea of these highly valuable horses being saved by the U.S. Army, but there didn't seem to be a lot of work done on it. I was also rather inspired by a book by Jack Higgins, the novelist, and it was called The Valhalla Exchange, which was all about a group of American soldiers fighting alongside German soldiers to defend French VIPs from the SS at the end of the war. And it was based on a true story which happened at a place called Castle Itter in Austria. So I thought, well, hang on a minute, there must have been more than one occasion when perhaps Allied and German soldiers fought together at the end of the war for various reasons. And it sort of came together with the story of the horses, and that indeed was the second occasion when U.S. and German troops fought together for a very rather strange political and economic purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I read the book, I've read the whole thing, and it was great. Yeah, I noticed you mentioned that incident, I believe. Are there other incidents that you came across? You don't have to name them if you plan to write about them.
No, not at all. No, that's it. There's just the two. There's my one, which happened sort of a couple of weeks before the end of the war, and then there was the Schloss Itter battle, which was just a few days before the end. Maybe there are others. It would be fascinating to find some.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I ask my questions, it will be difficult to ask them as though I haven't read it, but obviously I have. So you lay the book out chronologically. How did you decide what to focus on step by step?
Well, I thought that the important focus on this story was to talk about the American soldiers themselves, why they chose to do such a seemingly insane thing as to go 20 miles behind German lines to save something as sort of esoteric as living art, if you like, these special horses from the Spanish riding school. And why would the Americans even care to do that? So I felt that although the subject had been covered on and off by other writers in magazine articles and a couple of small books, I felt that their focus was always entirely on the horses, telling the story of, you know, how impressive and amazing they were. But I wanted to tell the story of the nitty-gritty aspects of hardened combat soldiers from the beaches of D-Day right through the Ardennes up and doing this special mission. And the Germans as well, why the Germans chose to cooperate with the Americans at that time. So, you know, my book is written, it's very much as a narrative nonfiction. So it's like a novel, but it's real and it's all, you know, properly referenced. And the idea is to carry you forward from the beginning of the negotiations, right through to the actual saving of the horses and the moving of them into Bavaria and the end of the war. So it follows a nice sort of chronological order. So I wanted to stick absolutely to what had occurred, but throwing a bit more focus and filling in more of the story which had not been told about how the Americans physically did it, which was not easy. It was an extremely difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And I'll point out, even though we sort of know in general how the story ends, it's still very interesting. There are little side issues that you bring up that that people wouldn't know. And so that part is interesting to follow along. And also I was struck by how important it was for the right people to be in place to make this happen. You know, I think it, you know, culturally speaking, I think the result was very important. So it seemed to be a close call all throughout based on individuals wanting to make it happen.
You're quite right. Without General Patton, for example, mm-hmm. his love of horses, this would never have got off the ground. Without Colonel Reed, who commands the 2nd Cavalry Group, this reconnaissance unit, his love of horses, again, it would not have been possible. And also the passion that the German veterinary surgeons felt for the horses that they were protecting, and the German head of the remount stud where the horses are kept. They're all very different men with very, very different backgrounds and different stories throughout the war, but they all come together on this one single idea, which is, as Colonel Reed said, we just wanted to do something beautiful. And I suppose after all the slaughter and mayhem on both sides, by sort of April 1945, to do something that's somehow a purifying thing, to save innocent animals who know nothing of war, yet they are such an important part of the story of the Second World War, and to save them and to give them back to a country which had been occupied by the Nazis, and, you know, and help save this amazing cultural treasure. Mm-hmm. So it's a very uplifting story. I found it extremely uplifting that men who'd been through so much were prepared to risk their lives at the very end, when they knew the Germans were defeated, it was only a matter of weeks and they would be on their way home to America, to put their necks on the line and push this forward and get it done. And they felt very strongly it had to be done.
So one thing in the book that you touch on to a point which might be, I guess, controversial, is that in a sense, these horses were war booty that either the Americans would end up getting, or the Russians, the Soviets, would end up getting. And in a sense, I was struck by the tone of the book was, if the Soviets get it, these horses, their legacy will be destroyed. For various reasons you point out, yep. I won't go into detail unless you want to. Mm-hmm. They will be lost forever. Mm. Some readers might... You know, there's the whole thing about Americans working with Germans, and then Soviets were supposed to be their allies, and that whole tension. So how might you respond to someone who says you're unfairly treating the Soviets in this mm-hmm. book?
Well, it is a valid point, but I have to say, based on what had happened previously to extremely valuable and famous horses that the Russians had got their hands on, for example, the Royal Hungarian stud, which was full of Lipizzaner horses, they had shot a good number of the staff, shot quite a few of the horses, and the rest had been basically harnessed as drays and taken off to haul ammunition wagons, and these are some of the most valuable horses in the world. There was a real fear that if Soviet peasant soldiers arrived in that area, they would have done enormous damage to something that was very, very fragile. Because at the end of the day, we have to understand that this story is really in two places. You have the famous stallions, which we all know from the Spanish riding school in Vienna, and they've been evacuated somewhere else, and they're really a kind of peripheral part of this story. But my story is focused on the mares and the foals. And of course, without the mares, if those mares are destroyed or their blood is tainted in some way through interbreeding with other horses, the whole idea of Lipizzaner horses and future stallions is completely lost. And it's very, very fragile. 300 or so horses that have to be kept under special circumstances. And the arrival of frontline Soviet units could have caused absolute mayhem. Not only that, but the staff themselves, who were in extreme danger, they had their wives and children with them. And we know from some of the behavior of Soviet troops in places like Nemersdorf in East Prussia, and a lot what was happening in Germany, they were in for a hard time when the Soviets arrived. And it was not good to be a German in those areas which were captured by the Red Army. So at the very least, the stud staff and all of the veterinary surgeons, everybody would have been separated from those horses and sent off as prisoners of war, never to be seen again, probably.
So, to be fair, your book also addresses the Waffen-SS, who seem to be hell-bent on suicidal destruction of the enemy and themselves, you know, like...
Yeah.
And in that case, all cultural treasures would be destroyed as well, you know, for, you know, on their actions.
Yeah, so the SS become a kind of a third party to the story. So the real issue initially was to get to the stud and rescue the horses before the Soviets took that area. And the Soviets were about 40 or so miles away from Hostal in what is now Western Czechoslovakia, and the Americans are 20 miles away. So they rush in and secure it and then work out how the hell can we actually move these horses, which is a very difficult thing to do to Bavaria. So that was the great fear. But of course, suddenly out of nowhere, you have the regular German army still fighting, but they basically allow the Americans a pass to come through a bit of their lines to take these horses out and we'll turn a blind eye. However, the SS are in a completely different ball game. They are retreating from other battles that they have fought in Austria and elsewhere. And it is true that an SS unit, Panzergrenadier unit, came up and launched a couple of fairly strong attacks against this place when they found this unit of Americans 20 miles behind the German front line. Now, we don't know what they were after. We can presume either they were trying to take the horses for themselves because they realized the value, perhaps as negotiating chips, bargaining chips. They wanted to kill Americans. They wanted to destroy the entire collaboration between Americans and Germans, which was evidently going on. They could see what was going on by observing the place. So it's a very peculiar situation. But the upshot was a lot of dead SS and a successful battle fought twice by the Americans with a lot of help, which I expect you'll talk about later, in beating off these attacks. So it's a good story, I'd say.
Yeah. And having read it, I feel, you know, by your style or the way you wrote it, it felt like I almost feel the sort of the tactile sensations of being there, the tension and the, you know, the castles and these, you know, pretty picturesque surroundings.
Yes.
With war flaming around them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate to do a couple of field trips there, and I walked all the ground and visited everywhere where everything occurred, and it's really unchanged, I have to say, from 1945. It's a beautiful landscape, you know, rolling hills and forest, and, you know, it's very ancient Bohemia, and you're quite right. And then you have all this violence occurring there, and it's one thing I've tried to do in quite a few of my books over the past few years. I want the reader to become immersed in the story. I want you to forget that you're reading a history book. There's nothing worse than being sort of lectured, you know, by a historian. I want you to forget that and just think, you know, wow, this is a really good, exciting story. And yes, it's footnoted, but you know, it carries you along and you start to care for the characters. You start to care for their journey and what happens to them. And you doubt and you worry whether they're going to actually make it through and be successful. So that is absolutely, you know, extremely filmic. That's what I'm aiming for. I want you to visualize it in your mind. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very pleased that it worked on you. So hopefully it worked on a lot of other people as well.
Yeah. And that was the logistical issue was also fascinating because these horses weren't kept as one group moved from one spot to another. It was they were all had to be split up because, what was it, hundreds of horses? You can't.
The problem is, yeah, they're overloaded with horses because the Germans had been moving horses to this place because it was so safe for so long. They'd been moving them from all over the place, firstly for a breeding program where they're trying to create what is called an Aryan war horse, which is some kind of bizarre veterinary experiment, which doesn't really pan out for them. And that was the great fear, that they would interfere with the Lipizzaners. They also had there, of course, some of the finest racing horses from Europe, which had been captured from the Rothschild collection and various others. They had some of the finest Arabian horses. So, I mean, as in, you know, nicking art, everything that wasn't nailed down, the Nazis took. And in this case, horses were a living treasure, and they took it and they used it. And by the end of the war, thank God, the German staff who were in charge could see their value and really thought that they couldn't allow them just to be swept away by the changing fortunes of the end of the war and the evident beginning of the Cold War, that something had to be done. And of course, the only choice they had were the Americans. That was it, really. They couldn't do it themselves, and they certainly didn't want to wait for the Russians to arrive. So they had to fall onto into the waiting arms of the Americans. And thank God, it was an American cavalry unit that was closest to where this was happening. And of course, these guys, some of the older officers, particularly Colonel Reed, had grown up in the horse cavalry before they handed in their horses and took over Stuart tanks and armored personnel carriers. So they still long for and hark for the smell of horses and riding horses, and they're all polo players and eventing and all this sort of stuff. So they knew immediately the value of this, which, so as you said at the beginning of your interview, it was just a perfect combination of the right people at the right time. You would remove one person or one particular event, it all goes completely pear-shaped and ends with, you know, destruction and loss.
Something you mentioned just a minute or so ago, of all the, I thought I was pretty familiar with, like, from the horrific and obscene to the ridiculous that the Nazis engaged in their activities. I thought I was pretty familiar with all of it, but then when in your book you mentioned they were trying to create an Aryan warhorse breed, I could only shake my head and say, really, does it not end like these ridiculous plans that they had?
Well, it's a lot of people don't realize that the Germans were relying on millions of horses to move around supplies. I mean, yes, they've got their Tiger tanks and all that amazing stuff, but really, for the bog standard general infantry units and whatever, they have to rely on thousands of horses to haul supplies. And the Germans are constantly trying to improve the bloodstock of horses to make them hardier, stronger, and better for battle conditions. And a German so-called geneticist, Dr. Gustav Rau, who was basically a horse breeder, he was given a laissez-faire pass to just do what he wanted with horses, and he experimented for years. And, you know, he thought to himself, why not take the very finest horses that exist, the best racehorses, the best Arabians, and these famous Lipizzaner horses, and try to breed them together. And perhaps it might produce some kind of magical, amazing horse, which would be so useful for the German war effort. He tried and tried. They ended up with deformed horses with funny hooves and all sorts of terrible problems had to be put down. And there was great resistance by the Spanish Riding School. The head of the Spanish Riding School, Colonel Podhaisky, who had been dragooned, basically, excuse the pun, into the German army as a colonel. He's an Austro-Hungarian. And he tried constantly to protect the Spanish Riding School for this level of interference. But he lost control of the mares, which were sent to Hostau. And he tried his best to monitor what was going on. But the Germans in charge at Hostau, Lieutenant Colonel Rudowski, also a very famous rider, was very careful, I think, to try to minimize Rau's damage done to these Austrian national treasures. And there's also a propaganda aspect as well. The Lipizzaner stallions held at the Spanish Riding School, they were used as a propaganda tool to try to keep up the morale of the Austrian people. And of course, with the bombing campaign by 1944, it's too dangerous to keep these animals there anymore. So it took a lot of negotiations even to get the stallions to safety in a castle, Arco Castle, near to Vienna. So everything was to play for. And as I think the common thread really of this interview is just how fragile and delicate the entire story is, and the threads could so easily be broken and lead to catastrophic disaster. You know, probably nobody would remember the Spanish Riding School today. It would just be something in history books which disappeared in 1945.
And it does make me wonder what things did disappear that we don't talk about anymore because of the war.
Absolutely. An awful lot. Yeah.
So are there any other, I know we've discussed a lot of the book, have we touched on all the themes and maybe secondary issues that you talk about in the book? Maybe others you want to bring up?
Well, one of the things I found which was fairly extraordinary was Patton's love of launching these sorts of operations, but his caution in associating himself with it too much, to the point where he told Colonel Reed, went to him basically through the command structure up to the Third Army headquarters and said, look, I've discovered all of this, some all these animals, we've been talking to the Germans, they're prepared to hand them over if we can organize something. And the Americans didn't want to go into Czechoslovakia, it was too dangerous. They wanted the Germans to bring them to the border, and the Germans pointed out quite rightly, said, well, we can't do that, it's foaling season, so you know, they're dropping foals every 5 minutes. No no way we can move these animals. So the Americans, ummed and ahed, and they thought, oh my God, we have to launch some kind of operation 20 miles behind the lines. They go to Patton, and Patton just said, get them, make it quick, which was his order. And then he told Reed, he said that, you know, if this goes right, there's glory in it for all of us, basically. If this goes wrong, it's your fault. Okay, it's nothing to do with me. Yeah. So I'll turn a blind eye, you get on with it. And the trouble is, because he'd launched an operation called Task Force Baum, which had been launched a couple of 3 weeks earlier, which was a fairly harebrained scheme to go and liberate a massive POW camp about 100 or so miles behind German lines at a place called Hammelburg in Germany. And that had gone catastrophically wrong. Captain Baum, who'd been, this New Yorker, had been sent in with this Sherman tanks, the whole business, really heavily armed. They'd have to fight their way all the way in. They had managed to liberate the camp, but found they couldn't remove the prisoners because most of them were too sick and infirm by this stage. Ended up surrounded by the Germans, fought to the end, and were either killed or captured. And then it emerged after World War II that in the camp at Hammelburg had been Patton's son-in-law, Colonel Waters, I believe, the U.S. Army. And there was a bit of a, at the time, there was a bit of a scandal that developed in the press that he was using his troops to basically carry out, you know, private family business. And regarding this issue of the horses, you know, a lot of people said at the time and afterwards that this was one of, you know, Patton's ego trips, basically. And fortunately, it came off okay, and everybody was fine, and it worked out well. There was that issue, and also the other thing which is fascinating, which I really enjoyed writing about, which hadn't really been covered so well elsewhere, was the actual negotiations to be how this in fact comes about, which is really weird because you have the Germans at the start doing their business, and they're worrying about what's happening. They're seeing refugees coming past every day, fleeing from the east, and they know the war's getting close. And they have parked about 10 miles away a Luftwaffe German Air Force intelligence unit, which had retreated from the Eastern Front. And this is where all this chain of happenstance begins, because the officer, a guy called Colonel Holters, who's in charge of this unit, is a mad horseman, just happens to be a mad horseman. He finds the stud, he starts visiting, he starts taking photographs of the horses and conversing with Colonel Rudofsky, and he warns him, he says, you know, you really need to make arrangements to get the hell out of here before the Russians arrive, for obvious reasons. But he can't move, his truck's run out of fuel, he's stuck, and he actually reaches out to the Americans first, with the idea of a bargaining chip that he can basically sell them all this secret information he has about the Soviets in return for him and his men, you know, getting a nice trip to a POW camp in England and onwards to the US. And in return, by the way, you may be interested in this, shows Colonel Reed the photographs of the horses. That's how it began. And this idea of talking to them, and then these very brave German veterinary officers and a very brave American officer called Captain Stewart, who volunteered to go backwards and forwards through the lines, talking to each side and negotiating over a couple of 3 days to actually bring about this operation. And, you know, they were nearly killed. They were captured by the Volkssturm Home Guard at one point and threatened with execution. They were nearly captured by the SS. And, you know, it's only because of these men and their passion for this sort of slightly lunatic operation and their love of horses, and they were prepared to put themselves on the line and do this. I mean, it's extraordinary. And, you know, thankfully they all survived, and they were all decorated, which is good. And they all came together after the war in the 60s and 70s, even the 1980s. They would go together to Vienna to see, you know, these wonderful exhibitions. And know that they were the people responsible for saving these animals. You know, they didn't blow their own trumpets or anything like this, but they were very very professional men. But it was wonderful. There was a bond between these Americans, these Germans, and these Austrians that lasted for the rest of their lives, which is amazing, I have to say.
Yeah, you actually so you alluded to there are two other interesting sets of people in this in the book. One, the refugees who seem to have a palpable presence.
Yeah.
And also the Russian Cossacks who fought for the Germans.
Oh, yes. Yeah. they're a fantastic group. So, yeah, I mean, these Russian Cossacks had retreated themselves from Poland without orders, and they were Lienz Cossacks who were fighting for the Germans, wore German uniforms with Cossack hats and swords and whatever, and expert horsemen. And a guy called Prince Amazov, who was their commanding officer, took a small unit with his wife and children and retreated with about 150 Polish horses, Panya horses, to the stud, and turned up and said, basically, give us shelter and look after our horses, which the last thing they needed were more horses to add to 700 or so horses they had. But of course, they're extremely useful, and they become incredibly useful during the retreat, Operation Cowboy, the actual removing of these animals under the American supervision to Bavaria. And it's extraordinary, you know. You've got these, so you've got this weird group. You've got American GIs, you know, just 100 or so of them. You've got Allied POWs who were released by the arrival of the Americans, who chose to stay on because they'd been working in the stud, looking after the horses. They love the horses as well. There were Brits, there were Aussies, there were New Zealanders, there were Serbs, French. And what did they ask for? They asked for weapons. And they asked to join what became known as Stuart's Foreign Legion, which was this madcap thing of the Americans didn't have enough troops there to defend the place. So Captain Stuart has to start recruiting and rearming field expedient, Allied POWs, Germans, all sorts. And they fight together against the SS. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And then the Cossacks. And so it's about a sort of weird sort of United Nations feel to it. All different, you know, creeds of nationality and political opinion, but all working together for one purpose only, to save the horses and save themselves at the same time, which is wonderful, I think, you know?
Yeah, yeah, at the end they all came together for the purpose of humanity and culture rather than anything else. Yes,
absolutely, absolutely.
So let's turn to the resources you used for the book. You mentioned some of what you used already. Can you elaborate?
Well, I had a lot of cooperation with relatives. I even managed to find one or two people who were still alive who took part in these operations, so now extremely elderly in their 90s, but they granted me interviews very kindly. I've always worked very closely with relations. You know, I'm writing, most of my books tend to be set in about 1944-45, and unfortunately most of the veterans have now passed on, so I do work very closely with those. And archivally, there was a massive material in the U.S. National Archives in Washington, College Park in Maryland, masses of material that I don't think anybody had ever looked at before. And it was all, you know, the radio chit chat and all of the combat action reports and everything. And, you know, you can build up literally a minute by minute account of what the hell is going on and who's doing what. And it was fascinating to be able to fill in those blanks, which really had remained completely blank, because the story is always told, oh yes, we're going to go and do this, now we've done it, we're there, we've got there. But what happened in those 2 days to actually get there, all the problems they had with the Germans, they had to fight their way in, they, you know, all this sort of stuff. So really fascinating. And I also had a lot of help from the 2nd Cavalry Association, which has been absolutely marvelous. I mean, they have wonderful military historians who know everybody, they know all the sources, and they managed to dig out amazing things, letters and diaries and photographs, which nobody had ever seen before, literally had never seen outside of a, you know, some kind of archive. Wonderful amount of material. So you put it all together, I think I've squeezed this about as hard as I can, for every drop of information I could possibly find. And from the German side, I had some help in German archives, and I was able to find all of the interrogation reports for the various German officers involved who were debriefed by the Allies after the war. So that provided the German side. And I thought it was very, very important to tell the German side of this story, which has also been largely ignored as well, because this is a major issue. I mean, they're defending their front line, and should they allow Americans to pass through 20 miles behind to do this and then perhaps come back out again? I mean, it's such a difficult thing for a general, anybody else, to allow to happen. And there's wonderful debates and arguments and issues there as well. And and even in the UK I was able to find quite a bit of archival material as well. So there's a mass of things out there. Sadly, as is always the case when I write these things, it's published, it goes out, and then 6 months later, somebody contacts me with, I found this box, you know, in the attic that belonged to my grandfather, who was, and there's some other thing I'd love to have put in, but, you know, that's just the way it goes. But, okay. Yeah.
So, and did you say the writing school, did it have, information?
Yes, the Spanish Writing School. I went to the Spanish Writing School in Vienna, and I very kindly had a wonderful tour all around the off-camera areas, if you like, looking at all the horses today and examining, you know, just on site, just to get a feel of the place, which does appear in the book. I drove hundreds of miles through Germany and Austria and the Czech Republic, visiting all of the places where everything actually occurred, which was fascinating. As I mentioned, very little changed in the Czech Republic because, of course, it eventually became communist Czechoslovakia, and there was very little money to change and, you know, improve these places. And since the Iron Curtain's fallen, you know, they've had quite hard times there. And so the stud is still there. It's in a very run-down condition. But I was fascinated. One of the satellite studs at a place called Smolau, which has now changed its name to a totally unpronounceable Czech name. However, the first thing I saw, I drove past, were white horses stood on the very in this very same paddocks outside the same buildings as before. They were not Lipizzaners, unfortunately, but it looked like the real thing, as it would have appeared in 1945. So fascinating. So I drove the way in. I went to quite a few military museums to get in and out of Chaffee tanks and jeeps and get a feel for the vehicles of the period and what it was like to be inside a little tank or a half track or whatever, and those sorts of things, you know, to try, as you very kindly pointed out, you know, the idea of trying to feel the texture of the period, the smells and the, you know, the language and all of this sort of thing that the GIs would have had at that period. So that was really important. I like to try to give my readers a kind of immersive experience. I want you to be immersed into that world of that, you know, 1945. So, and I think it's, although there's a kind of weird train spottery sort of thing in people, I think, but I have to get things right. I want the uniforms described right, the, you know, the equipment, the weapons and everything done correctly. And also the military tactics and way things are done. I spend a lot of time talking to former US servicemen, both from the World War II period and more recently cavalry people, to make sure that I got the you know, everything right, the radio communications right, the orders, the way they're given, which are different from the British military, which I'm more familiar with. So you have to write, you know, these things carefully, and also from the German side. So, so I try to give it a rich texture, which I think it does have. I'm very pleased with that, I have to say. And I think I'm always very pleased when U.S. veterans of the period who've read the book contact me and say, yeah, that's accurate. That felt right. So I feel, thank God, I've done the right thing then. That's the important, that's the guys I've got, not editors of newspapers or whatever. It is veterans who were there or did similar kind of antics that say, yeah, that was correct. So that's what I always look for and strive for.
Nice. Were you able to come across any of the physical items associated with this operation? You know, maybe one of the makeshift trucks or saddles even that someone rode or anything like that?
No, unfortunately, there are a few things in the, there's a museum in Germany, which is still part of the 2nd Cavalry because they're based at Wilsdeck in Germany still as part of the US forces in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they have quite a few bits and pieces there that were used, weapons and bits and pieces. But unfortunately, most of this stuff has become scattered to the winds, sadly. But fortunately, everything that was used on the American side, German side, you can find it pretty much in most museums. It's fairly, you know, standard equipment and things like this. In the Spanish Riding School, they, of course, have things that existed during that period that we used with some of those famous horses, which are still kept in their museum there, which I was able to look at, which was fascinating. And I think also one of the things I always get very excited about, I love to stand in the place I'm writing about, you know, to be there. And I try to go around the time of the year when it was happening to try to get the weather conditions, the feel of that, you know. Right. And I was very lucky around Hostau in those areas because it's so unchanged. You know, I stood there literally expecting a Willy's Jeep to come around the corner any minute or something. You know, you could just feel that atmosphere was still there. It's almost sort of contained in Aspic or something. It's unchanged, that region. Absolutely brilliant. So I would urge anybody who's in that area, go and have a look for yourself. It's very easy to drive in from Germany, and it's well worth a trip to see where these events actually took place. And I think that's true for any thing that you write about, whether it be D-Day or the Ardennes or whatever. It's important to go on to the ground itself, because I've often found when you read reports, perhaps you read somebody else's work, and you know they haven't been there, because you can tell once you've been there, and you can compare and contrast. And then if you read the actual military operational reports, they tell a quite different story, because you know what can seem quite far away in a book is a 5-minute journey or a 3-minute journey or something, and that can really change the whole dynamics of telling that story and fill in some of the blanks that may have seemed rather mysterious before. So that's always fun. Researching is the really fun part, and writing is very exciting as well. And then after that, it just disappears to the publishers and editors, and then I move on to my next project. I mean, we're talking about this now, but I'm already three books down the road now onto other projects. So it's quite funny. I have to keep sitting back trying to remind myself, now, who was that? What was the name of that guy? And it seems a long time ago, but it was only quite recently that I was doing it, because it does take, I suppose this one, I started looking at this one about 2 years before I wrote it, and then I put it aside for a while, and I did a bit of research on something else, and I came back to it, and I kept thinking, this is a really good story, but it needs to be told well. That's where it's got to be told correctly, with a military historian's eye, not just an interest in horses. So I got through a previous project, got that done, and I thought, I must do this one now, get it done. And unfortunately, the publishers were very, very, DiCapo in the US in particular, were very, very interested. And some people probably who are watching this may remember a Disney film called The Miracle of the White Stallions, which was made in about 1968, I think it was, with Robert Taylor, I think, as the main character, which was a highly fictionalized version of this story. And that fictionalized Disney film, a Hollywood version, has really informed a lot of people about what happened about the story of the White Stallions. But, of course, the true story is considerably more gritty, a little bit horrible in places, much more to play for, and certainly not a Disney story by any stretch of the imagination at all.
So you had mentioned, I was going to ask what you found most enjoyable in your research.
Well, I, for me, it's when I first get the idea, when I first see something that is doable. I mean, I have to spend some time, I kind of stress test the idea. So I get an idea, I try to find everything I can that may exist about it that's easy to find to start with, you know, libraries and bits and pieces, or any online sources, historical societies, these sorts of things. And then most importantly for me, because I'm writing narrative nonfiction, it has to have a narrative arc to it. It has to have some kind of story with a resolution to it. I don't want to simply tell a history book story. So, and I really want a happy ending. That's quite important. You know, I like the fact everybody goes home for tea and medals at the end of it. That's good, you know, because if you invest all your time in reading my book, I don't want you to be, you know, contemplating suicide at the end of it, because it's so depressing. I want you to be happy and think, oh, well, that was a bit of a rough ride, but yeah, they did it. Oh, I feel great. That's fantastic. Just as in a film, you know, so you feel good. So that's important. And if it has that filmic quality to it, the clear narrative arc, then I will start the deep research that will take months and months and months and months, and then a lot of traveling and everything else, and really commit to it. And you know, you live with it day in, day out for about 18 months until the project is done. You just live and breathe that. And I have further immersion techniques I use, which is I I watch a lot of old films from the sort of 1940s, 50s period, black and white ones, to really immerse myself into that world, because those actors and people were all soldiers themselves in the Second World War. They look the part. They're correct. Not like the modern sort of stuff which is done now. So it's done correctly. So, you know, you watch The Longest Day, you watch all those sorts of films to try to get into that kind of thing. So it's like a bit of a weird immersive experience. But I know other writers that use that technique as well. And I read a lot of books around the period. And I have a lot of useless knowledge anyway, which I've been storing away for years about this, that, and the other. So it comes into play. Visiting museums helps. I think, what I particularly love these days is the fact that you have so many kind of living history societies, and you have so many, antique vehicle rallies and things like that. So you can go and get a hands-on experience of what a Sherman tank looks like and smells like, and what is it like to be inside something like that, and perhaps being shot at, you know, to get your hands on the weapons and the kit and everything else, which is also really interesting. You can probably see behind me there's a few American M1 helmets on the shelf there, but they're sort of props. I hold them, I think, well, this is, you know, get the whole idea of the thing. It's quite useful. You pick them up as you're going along, but so that's quite useful. And then it's the eureka moments when you're digging through archival stuff. And the other thing I've always really loved and enjoy is when I'm handling something that nobody has looked at since 1945 or something. It's just been shoved into an archive. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. And it's unopened. And there it is. This wonderful story. Somebody's story is there, you know, in this kind of thing. And there it is. And you're the first person to see it. And it's like holding, you know, gold in your hands, effectively. It's brilliant, fascinating stuff. And it's immediate as well, because there's this kind of immediate connection back to the last person who handled that or signed that off or whatever you see. I mean, one of the weirdest things I had was handling stuff Winston Churchill had last held himself, and he'd signed it at the bottom with his initials in green ink, you know, Winston Spencer Churchill, and to make sure everybody had he'd seen it, signed that off, and then it'd been archived. And so I was the next person basically to see that after Churchill, and I thought, my God, that's history, isn't it? That's really exciting stuff, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely. So what did you find for this book? What was the most surprising thing you found in your research?
Well, that's a difficult one to say. I think it is the just how difficult it was to actually do the operation, because, as I mentioned before, most books that have talked about this, whether it's in a chapter or an article or whatever, they make it sound quite easy. It's just, you know, we drive in, take the horses, faff around a little bit, and then get them back to Bavaria. You know, fantastic, great, easy. But it wasn't easy. It was a logistical nightmare. It was a really dangerous proposition. It was asking an awful lot of ordinary GIs who didn't give, you know, two figs about horses, to tell you the truth. You know, some guy from the Bronx or something is being asked, oh, by the way, for the last 9 months you've been shot at by the Germans. Would you mind now, as the end is now in sight, getting into this Jeep, driving with us to go and, you know, save a bunch of foreign horses that belong to somebody else? Oh yeah, I'd love to do that. Thanks very much. And, you know, get my, you know, last person to get shot in the European theater of operations, you know, you don't want to be that guy. But yeah, there was a bit of problem. It was quite difficult to sell that one, but I have to say the discipline was excellent, and they understood it was important to do it. So that was very difficult. And also the degree in which, you know, we tend to, I think, in many of these sorts of books and films and everything else, the enemy, the Germans, are these sort of faceless characters in the background. You know, they're just somebody to get shot or surrender or whatever. And I think I was able to bring out their humanity a little bit, that some of them were good men working for the wrong side, basically. They were good men working for an evil organization. But they knew at the end that they had to break that oath of allegiance that they had to Hitler. They had to do something to save the horses, and by doing that also in some way save themselves from what they had effectively, you know, signed up to do, if you like, to support such a regime. You know, the light dawned upon them at that point that they needed to get with the program and help the Americans. I thought that was wonderful as well, and it's interesting that quite a few of the Germans in the film, in the book, actually ended up in America. One of them ended up as the zoo at San Diego as the veterinarian, which is amazing, I have to say. Yeah. So permanent friendships, wonderful, you know.
Yeah, no, I definitely, in the book, I sensed the guilt that they had. They were still military men who,
yeah,
they were forced to break their oath of allegiance for something they decided was more important.
Yeah. And I think also the other thing is there is a difference. There is a similarity and a difference in the German side is very correct and proper, Prussian kind of officer ethic that they must do the correct thing. And you can tell even with the arguments they're having with quite senior generals, General Weisenberger, for example, who's left in charge of this section of the line. He knows the war's finished, but he's not going to break his oath to a man that he doesn't agree with anymore, which is hilarious. And even after Hitler is dead, they know Hitler's dead, they continue fighting because they believe it is their duty to defend their country from enemies. And they will not break their oath, their officer's oath of allegiance to the army and everything else. So there's kind of stiff back, kind of Prussian thing going on there. On the other side, you have the Americans a bit more relaxed about that sort of aspect, but nonetheless also on a mission. They are on a mission, as they see it, to liberate Europe from evil. And they are absolutely switched on and focused to get that job done as quickly as humanly possible so they can go home to their wives and kids and their lives, which have been interrupted by this war. And other people like Colonel Reed, who was a professional soldier from before the war, you have that small number of officers and men who were, you know, pre-war professionals. The army's been their life and their love, I have to say. And this was in many ways the sort of icing on the cake to a fairly horrible 9 months from Normandy right through particularly the Ardennes campaign in the winter of 44-45. You know, it's springtime in Czechoslovakia, and it's just at the end of that horrible, harsh winter, and then this wonderful thing happens, and then the war finishes, which is which is good for everybody, you know. So it's I like that, you know.
So what was there a question or issue you were trying to research that was particularly difficult to come to a conclusion on, or perhaps you still it's still an open question for you?
Well, it was just the only thing that I found was difficult. It seems that the U.S. archives had been, how can we say politely, sifted at some point. Certain documents must have been removed to do with this operation. There are slight gaps here and there. For example, some of the everyday reports of units, which you would expect to find, seem to be missing, or elements of them are missing. So perhaps, I don't know, something else was going on. I think mostly the problem was why some of the archives have been sifted slightly, that they leave a little bit of gaps here and there. I think it's because the Czechoslovak government, after the war, they launched a legal case against the U.S. government saying that these horses belong to Czechoslovakia because they're on Czech territory when the war ended, and you basically looted them for your own, you know, benefit. And the Americans were a little bit cagey about this. There is, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of post-war legal transcripts about in Washington arguing about whether we have in fact nicked these horses or whether they are spoils of war or whatever. Now, regarding the Lipizzano horses that belong to the Spanish Riding School, the Americans returned those as soon as they could to Austrian control. And that was the good thing. But when it came to the Arabian stallions and the racehorses, quite a few of those did end up being shipped off to the US, and some of them ended up in private hands. And some of these very famous racehorses were auctioned off from various army bases in the few years after the war. And so there was a bit of a, I can't say exactly a cover-up, but they would prefer not to talk about that aspect of it because it left a little bit of a bad taste that perhaps there was an element of somehow looting or whatever. Regarding the Czech government's claim, well, this is nonsense because, yes, those horses happened to be on Czech territory, which was occupied by the Germans at the time and then was occupied by the Soviet Union. The horses themselves belonged to either individual families in Europe, in France and elsewhere, or to institutions such as the Spanish Riding School or other studs which have been destroyed through war. So it's a bit of a thing. I didn't really go into that too much at the end of the book because my focus was really 100% on the Lipizzana story, which was good. I mean, they only lost a few horses they had to shoot through accidents and whatever, but nearly all of them were returned in full working condition back to the Spanish riding school. So that's pretty much the only thing, I think.
Interesting. What did you come across that had the most emotional impact on you, either positively or negatively?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a really difficult question. Yeah. Well, I think it was the moment at the stud when Captain Stewart, the American officer who'd been sent on this mission backwards and forwards trying to negotiate, he was hidden up in the stud because the German commanding officer threatened the veterinarians who were negotiating with the Americans. He threatened them with treason charges. You're negotiating with the enemy without my permission. He was very nervous. He didn't know what to do, basically, and he changed his mind later. But Stuart was released from hiding in Dr. Lessing's house, the German veterinarian, he comes out and he's walking across one of the yards, and there's a couple of little blonde-haired kids there, and they stop, and they shout Heil Hitler at the American and raise their arms in salute. They're only about 8, 9 years old. And Dr. Lessing walked over and patted them on the head, and he explained that they were his daughter and son. And he apologized for them giving the salute, but of course they're all indoctrinated to do that. And at that moment, Captain Stewart knew what the real score was. It was the horses, it was the kids, it was their wives, it was everything that they were risking being put up against a wall and shot in order to save that which they loved, which in this case was their families and these animals, and they would do anything to save them from what was considered a fate worse than death, which was coming quite clearly from the east. And I found that very touching. And Stuart, who only died a few years ago, he wrote about that. He felt very touched by that as well. The penny dropped at that point. That's why the Germans are doing this. It's not about Hitler, it's not about the war, it's not about the army, it's about just saving that which you have tenderly nurtured, whether it be your children or these horses. They must be saved.
Yeah.
And you can die trying.
Yeah. I remember that part in the book. It was pretty intense.
Yeah.
So apart from entertaining people, what do you hope the book will do?
Well, I hope that people go away and they think about what their grandfathers, great-grandfathers did in World War II, generally, whether they be British, American, or whatever, that we owe a massive debt of gratitude to these people. And I've always felt very strongly about, you know, veterans' affairs and things like this. And my whole intention with these sorts of books, I've written quite a few of these sort of books recently, these men on a mission things or whatever, is to try to give back a voice to men whose stories would be otherwise forgotten in the deluge of World War II literature and everything else. And I want to say to people that don't think that every story from World War II has been told. I mean, there are amazing stories that would make your hair stand on end, you know, absolutely extraordinary stories of courage and bravery that are simply forgotten, that are sitting in archives and libraries and places waiting to be told. And I think as historians, it's our job to try to find them and you know, throw light onto them. That's really important. And I'd urge everybody who can either go to the Spanish Riding School and watch a performance or go and see Lipizzana horses in America. There's quite a few now in the US who also do the same. And go and look at those animals and think that without your country's servicemen risking their necks, there is no way on earth those horses would exist today. I guarantee it. They would have been lost. That's how, you know, fine. And, you know, Europeans have a great debt to pay, I think, to both United States and other allied soldiers, British as well, the monuments men and all of those sorts of people who went into Europe specifically to try to save art and culture. And that's the hardest possible thing to do in the midst of a war, to convince people not to blow up churches that may have German snipers in them, and in this thing, you know, to risk 100 and 200 or so men's lives, grizzled veterans, you know, who'd had enough, frankly, by this stage, to go and do this. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
But I think animals do touch people. You know, in Britain, we're very, very silly about dogs and cats and horses, you know. We're very, very sentimental about animals, and I think Americans are as well. Yeah. And you know, I've had an awful lot of people contact me from Kentucky and places like that who have horses and all this, and they absolutely loved it because it spoke to them. They understood why you want to go and do that, because they understand the bond between a man and a horse, a man and a dog, and whatever, you know. It is there. So I think that's why it's an unusual story. Not only the allies and enemies fight together, but it's also that it's an issue of animals who are seen as innocent. They're kind of unsullied by human evilness and nastiness, and but unfortunately are quite often victims of it. And so this had a happy ending, but not so many other horses, has to be said. But
So you mentioned some of the time it took to write the book. Can you touch on any difficulties you had in finishing it and getting it published?
No, I didn't have any problems finishing it. I finished it early, which is good. I loved it so much. I was just work like crazy. I really enjoy the writing process once I've done all the research and everything. Apart from a few issues with archival stuff, not being able to locate it or taking a long time to find certain things or people slow to get back to me. But apart from that, it was fine. It was quite straightforward. It was a very pleasurable process, I have to say. I learned an awful lot that I didn't know. I used to ride horses myself when I was younger and things, and I worked in stables and things like that. But I didn't know the half of it, to tell you the truth. And it is a fascinating, you know, you learn so much by researching these things, and you learn so much, not only military things, but also just human behavior and desires and things like that. It's absolutely fascinating. There are so many little side stories that you could go off on a tangent with this and write lots of other things about it, and maybe somebody will one day. There are other stories connected to this, but mine is very much focused just on the Lipizzaners itself.
So what are these the writing projects that you pursued after this book? Can you mention those?
Well, indeed, I've worked on quite a few books I've written subsequently, I've just finished a book called we changed the title several times, so I don't remember what the title is we've settled on. It's not published yet, but it's coming out later this year. Operation Swallow, that's it. Operation Swallow was settled on now. And that's a really extraordinary story. It's another one of these stories I couldn't believe hadn't really been told in any great detail. It's about Jewish American prisoners of the Germans, USGIs, who were captured in the Ardennes. And they segregated what they thought were Jewish Americans. In fact, they grabbed anybody who looked as they thought Jewish, and they sent them off to a concentration camp for heavy labor on a top secret project where they were brutalized and murdered and things like this. And three of them, including their senior man, escaped and tried to get to the Allied front lines to tell them what the hell was going on. And that's the story of this man who was not Jewish himself, and his friends, and how they put up with unimaginable brutality. And these were US prisoners of war, military prisoners of war, treated in the utmost disregard by the Germans. And how they come through it all and survive and bring out this story, which was then suppressed by the American government after the war for a long time, because it was very, very embarrassing. So that's what I finished the book, and we're just in the editing process now, and that one's coming out later this year in the US and also the UK. And I'm currently working on a new project, which I can't tell you anything about because it's top secret, but it's really fun, and I'm off to Germany and Austria shortly doing field research for that, so it's going to be a good one.
Okay. And where can people find you online?
Well, I'm all over the place. So I have my website, which is markfelton.co.uk. You can find a lot of stuff about my books on there and articles and things like that. And I also have a fairly good presence now on YouTube. So I make a lot of YouTube films about lots of things I'm interested in that couldn't possibly be books because they're too small or whatever. So that's Mark Felton Productions on YouTube. And we're almost at 100,000 subscribers. So I'm about to have a mad celebration for that. Should be popping some champagne when we eventually get there, hopefully in the next few days. So that's really good. So it shows there's a great love of military history amongst all age groups. So that's good. So do check that out. I'm sure they'll find something interesting on there to watch.
Yeah. I've had this debate about young people being interested in military history. And I've said that whereas maybe they're not so much into the dates and you know, the actual timelines, they are definitely into the whole feel of it, especially with the video games. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I get a lot of mail from people from all ages who've read my books or watched my films or seen me on some TV documentary or whatever. They write to you about different things. And, you know, I had a letter only recently from an 11-year-old in America who wrote to me about a book I wrote called Zero Night, which is about British officers escaping from a POW camp, which is being made into a film later. This young man found it very inspiring. He found that the behavior of these people and their refusal to give up and refusal to lie down, very inspiring in his own life as an 11-year-old at school, that he felt he could take some inspiration. And I took that kind of inspiration myself, 11, 12 years old, reading the Colditz story, reading about Douglas Bader, the famous British fighter ace missing both legs. And I thought, blimey, if these guys can do that, you know, what are we complaining about? You know, we've got it pretty easy. We should, you know, dig in and get stuck in and get on with it. And they are very, very inspiring people. Yeah. You know, both of my grandfathers were World War II combat veterans. And, you know, I learned an awful lot at their knees, I have to say. And I think that sparked my interest in this. But it's, they really were a very, very special generation indeed, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. They went through a lot. They did a lot.
Yeah.
So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
Oh, not at all. I think that's very, very thorough. Yeah, I think apart from buy the book and read it.
Oh, yeah.
Good. If you don't buy that book, read other history books, which is important.
Yeah.
There we go. Yes. Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Is this the same cover? I got a review copy. I don't know.
No, I've got the British version. I've got both versions over here. So I've only had hardback copies, but I presume a paperback's coming out as well soon. So that's fantastic. I think there's an audio version as well, which people can listen to.
Okay.
As well as Kindle, which is great. So if you don't like reading books, you can certainly listen to it or something like that, which is good.
Yeah. All right. That's all the questions I have. So thank you for speaking with me.
Brilliant. It's a pleasure.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H. C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.